Hello, I'm Keith Powell, and welcome to Focus Asia Pacific from PCJ Radio International. A week after bushfires destroyed more than 200 homes in the Australian state of New South Wales, authorities are preparing for the possibility of more devastation. Firefighters are bracing for worsening weather conditions with hot, dry winds with temperatures hovering around 35 degrees Celsius. Crews worked through the night, backburning, and to try to get under control several large blazes, particularly in southern highlands and Hawkesbury and the Blue Mountains. Firefighters are backed by millions of dollars of special equipment, from bulldozers and bulk water tankers to helicopters. Brandon Trembath has more.
Helicopters have been in heavy demand as bushfires rage in the Blue Mountains and Lithgow. Joshua Wales from Wollongong-based Touchdown Helicopters flew in yesterday to relieve a fellow pilot who's been here for a week.
And we're basically in the Jet Ranger doing air observation work, essentially mapping the fire line and looking for hot spots.
He's concerned about the expected winds today, gusting from 40 to 60 knots. If the wind is too fierce, flights will be grounded.
The wind may blow smoke away, but then the wind strengthening will make conditions extremely difficult and dangerous flying in the valleys, particularly for water bucketing operations.
Helicopters are also being used to insert firefighters into rugged terrain.
Landing pads are often difficult. It's not uncommon to find a very small hole and put your crew in. They'll then chainsaw a few trees down and make the landing pad a little bigger. Sometimes you can't even land properly. You do hover exit techniques to get them in and out whilst the helicopter's still in the hover.
Remote area firefighting teams use hand tools to clear vegetation and conduct backburns. Jules Bross from the National Parks and Wildlife Service of New South Wales says it's hot and tiring work, but they're well prepared.
You're always wearing a helmet. You wear protective clothing and your boots and things like that. But of course you're working normally in really hot, rugged conditions, and so you need to take lots of water. That's always the trouble, taking enough water and food for the day as well.
Tony Callan plays a different role in the firefighting effort. The contractor from Bathurst has many a boy's dream job, driving an 18-ton bulldozer.
Basically started with a Tonka toy when I was a kid and thought I wanted to be a bulldozer driver, and have been ever since.
Tony Callan cuts fire breaks behind homes and roads for water tankers to travel. Rocky Gazzoli from A1 Earthworks in Mudgee drives one of the biggest tankers with a 15,000-litre capacity. He fills his truck at a nearby dam in next to no time.
I just pull up alongside the dam, hook your hoses up, start your pumps. Takes me about 12 minutes from go to woe. Then I've got to go to a place where the small units come in and I fill their little trucks.
Rocky Gazzoli expects today will be a tough one, but he's not worked up about it.
I think in this game, I've been to a few fires, you just got to take day at a time. You're just unsure until the day, depending on the weather, depending on the winds, the temperature. You just got to take day at a time.
It's been alleged that Australian-supplied helicopters were used by Indonesia's military to kill thousands of civilians in the central highlands of Papua in the 1970s. The allegations are among a series of other rights abuses detailed in a new report from the Asian Human Rights Commission, a Hong Kong-based non-governmental organization. Australian authorities say they are looking into the matter. Asghar Subarti spoke to Basil Fernando, the Policy and Program Director of Asian Human Rights Commission.
They did a lot of things which are, you know, very humiliating and rather gruesome to tell in detail. But in the report, we have given quite a bit of detail of these things. What those gruesome details show is also there was a humiliating element. Humiliated people to submission. So that is the basis, is the killings and the other sufferings imposed on the people, and the fact of trying to bring them to submission, that we have named as a genocide.
These human rights abuses are alleged to have taken place under the rule of the now deceased former Indonesian President Suharto. Who do you think should answer to these allegations?
Well, the basic international law position is that it is the state and the commanders of the military. We have named the particular battalions which were used during this, and they can easily be named, the individuals involved can easily be named. We are talking about something of a living memory.
Are these alleged culprits that you've identified in positions of power in Indonesia right now?
Some of them are still there, but some are retired. So the retirement does not extinguish their responsibilities. These people can be, if there is serious attempt, can be brought to justice.
And what's your assessment of the current state of Indonesia's Papua provinces?
The military control of the area, which is now prevailing with constant violence, is the reality of Papuan people, which is, you know, very much documented almost by many human rights organizations on a constant basis.
Chinese diplomats have defended their country's human rights record at a major UN hearing in Geneva, Switzerland. UN members faced Human Rights Council hearing once every 4 years, but China's record attracts more attention than most. The Beijing delegation said China's record is improving, but there was still scathing criticism from many nations, with a lack of political and civil rights as a recurring theme. Bill Bertels reports.
If ever there was a reminder of China's problematic human rights record, it appeared in the form of Tibetan protesters scaling the UN headquarters in Geneva ahead of the hearings. Inside, China's diplomats defended the country's human rights record and said progress has been made.
In minority areas, religious freedom and ethnic language rights receive full guarantees. China's investment in these areas is continuing to grow.
China's delegation leader, Wu Heilong, said despite criticism, China is making efforts.
We think in regards to human rights, there's no best, there's just better. Efforts to promote and protect human rights are always underway and never-ending.
The UN human rights hearing gives other countries the chance to raise concerns, and many Western countries put forward a range of issues, including Australia's representative Ruth Stone.
Australia recognises that China has taken since its 2009 UPR and recommends China 1, strengthen protection of ethnic minorities' religious, socioeconomic and political rights, ensuring reports of violations are promptly and transparently investigated. 2, permanently lift restrictions on access to minority areas. 3, work towards abolition of the death penalty. 4, expedite legal and institutional reforms to fully protect in law and in practice freedom of expression, association and assembly, and religion and belief. 5, increase transparency of its traditional and social media by guaranteeing the rights of Chinese citizens to freely critique any state organ or functionary. And 6, enhance cooperation with the OHCHR by agreeing to outstanding requests for visits to China and extending a standing invitation for future UN special procedures requests.
Sophie Richardson is the China Director for Human Rights Watch, based in Washington, D.C. She hopes Australia will raise the same concerns at a higher level.
I can only hope that Prime Minister Abbott and Foreign Minister Bishop echo specifically and publicly all of those concerns when they make their first visits to Beijing. We've certainly been concerned that Mr. Abbott failed to do so at APEC and seemed to imply that China's human rights situation wasn't bad enough to merit public comment.
She says many countries that shied away from raising concerns at the first periodic review of China's human rights record 4 years ago were more vocal this time around.
I think we saw a lot more African states, Latin American states raise concerns about things like limitations on the freedom of expression or the application or the ongoing use of the death penalty or the government's failure to ratify the ICCPR.
Beijing will have a chance to formally respond to the concerns, though the foreign ministry has already said for ill-intended and biased criticism, it will respond by maintaining its own path and abiding by its own judgment. Sophie Richardson says despite a leadership change last year that elevated Xi Jinping to the presidency, little has changed on the human rights front.
There's a heavy emphasis on economic development and on certain kinds of social and cultural rights, very much at the expense of civil and political rights. But even within the realm of claims about, say, better access to education or better access to the right to health, there was no discussion at all of some of the kinds of egregious abuses that Chinese human rights organizations and organizations like mine have documented. So it was a fairly standard formula, which was essentially to state the positives as they see them and deal with all problems by saying in the abstract how things are or ought to be according to Chinese law, rather than answering for the very specific factual criticisms that were being raised in the dialogue itself.
China and India have signed a defense agreement aiming at avoiding military conflicts along the ill-defined border. Under the deal, the two sides will exercise maximum self-restraint to avoid a flare-up of territorial tensions that have historically marred ties between the two countries. The border pact followed a meeting in Beijing between Chinese Premier Li Qingqing and the visiting Prime Minister Mohammed Singh. Tom Maddox reports from Beijing.
Upon signing the border agreement, the visiting Indian Prime Minister Manmohan Singh told reporters, "When India and China shake hands, the world notices." India's leader has labelled the deal a strategic benchmark.
"Premier Li and I have agreed that peace and tranquility on our borders must remain the foundation for growth in the India-China relationship. Even as we move forward, the negotiations toward a fair, reasonable and mutually acceptable settlement to the India-China boundary question. This will be our strategic benchmark."
The border dispute has soured relations for decades, but Chinese Premier Li Keqiang sought to downplay those tensions.
"There are far more common interests than differences between China and India. China and India are two old civilizations. Our two peoples have the wisdom and our two governments have the ability to manage our differences along our border so that they will not affect the overall interests of our bilateral relationship."
The key outcome of the deal is that the two sides will show maximum restraint in the event border forces come into contact, and that they won't tail each other along the ill-defined border, known as the line of actual control. It's no breakthrough, but a significant development on previous deals, says R.N. Das, senior fellow at India's Institute for Defence Studies and Analyses.
"Now, the line of actual control is not defined. So what happens is that sometimes the Indian side feel that this is our side of the line of actual control, and the Chinese side, they also feel that that is their perception of the line of actual control. That leads to conflict. But now this is that in the areas of line of actual control where there is no common perception, neither side will tail the other. So that is certainly a significant improvement."
Chinese and Indian forces will also exchange more information and meet more often.
"They are having more number of border personnel meetings. So in case of a sort of border intrusion by either side, the two sides can talk to each other."
China and India fought a brief war in 1962, and the border between them has never been properly defined. The dispute erupted in April this year when Chinese troops allegedly advanced into Indian-held territory, sparking a military standoff. Author and professor Willie Lam is from the Chinese University of Hong Kong. He says this new deal might avoid border conflict, but mutual settlement still eludes the two countries.
"This is one more attempt at confidence building in a very long border area, which has a long history also of mutual conflict. So the fact that they're setting up a hotline and also promising to notify the other of troop movements, I think could avert a happening of unexpected events. However, I think the negotiations regarding a final border solution is still illusory. So I think much needs to be done, even though this is one step forward."
Underlying the border dispute, Chinese-Indian relations have been marked by a lack of trust. Willie Lam says that must improve before a final solution can be reached.
"In cases like this, I think mutual trust is very important. But China and India have been engaging in an arms race, and I think in terms of the overall mutual regard which Chinese and Indians have for each other, I think there has been a rise in negative feelings and sentiments towards each other. So I think both governments should promote people-to-people exchanges, and also perhaps if the economic and trade relations were to improve, then this might promote a better atmosphere for them to negotiate a border treatment, which I think they have been doing without substantial results for the past 20 years or so.
And you're listening to Focus Asia Pacific, coming to you from PCJ Radio International. One of China's leading academics has spoken out against his sacking from the country's most prestigious university. Economics professor Xia Lingyang was linked to a petition demanding sweeping reforms to China's one-party system. The Peking University professor was dismissed for poor teaching, and the move had nothing to do with politics. But Professor Xia denies this and says he is going to appeal, although he knows it's doomed to fail. He speaks next to Walid Ali.
Always advocates constitutional democracy, rule of law, all kind of freedoms. And I think that China should have the check and balance to limit the power of the officials and the government. And also advocate the liberalism, free market ideas. They think that they cannot, nowadays they publish some articles in official Communist Party journals called Qiushi. They criticize liberalism, criticize the constitution, and also universal values.
You've been outspoken for quite a while. In fact, back in 2008, you helped the jailed Nobel Peace Laureate Liu Xiaobo draft the Chapter 8 petition, which was looking at human rights and freedom of association and democracy. But at that time, there was no action that was taken against you. Why do you think this is happening now?
At that time, they have some house arrest and some telephone tapping, and sometimes they stop me. I don't have the individual freedom at that time, but they didn't dismiss me. I think at that time they have a lot of people, individuals toward, and now I'm getting to be a kind of signal among university intellectuals, especially emphasize on liberalism and the constitution. So I think that they will choose a target to punish them, to threat the other intellectuals in the university. So in recent stage, you could see some lawyers has been arrested, and even cartoon painter was arrested. So each time they choose one target to threat the others, that's like a Chinese old proverb goes, to kill one, to threat 100. They dismiss me, then more professors in university will be threatened not to speak.
And the focus at the moment is on academics, and so it's like your time has come, I suppose, is what you're saying. That means you're faced with a decision now. What are you going to do? Will you have to leave China?
Yeah, first I'd like to have the appeal, a written appeal, and then I'll talk with the vice president of Peking University. Some people suggest I have the lawsuit. I won't win in any way, but maybe I could try to express myself in some way.
And if that ultimately doesn't succeed, what happens?
I can never win. I will see what will be the next step. If they do something further, and I will respond. But I don't want to wasting too much time to argue with them. I know it's no results.
Can you go to another university?
So far, I don't think that any Chinese universities did dare to accept me, even though the authorities say it's not a political issue. It's only a pure academic issue. But I don't think that anyone dared to accept me. I said I'd like to accept a teaching post or research position or even librarian job.
Should you be speaking to us? I know you've been warned not to speak to the international media. Is this a good idea?
I think when I talk to foreign media, then my voice can be heard in many places. But in China, there's no Chinese domestic media that dare publish what I'm saying. So it's a very limited space for me to respond in my Twitter and my microblog. My microblog only existed for over 15 hours.
In order to turn China into an urban nation, local governments across the country have been demolishing tens of millions of homes over the past decade. Homeowners have fought back, blocking heavy machinery and battling officials. In recent years, resistance has taken a disturbing turn. Since 2009, at least 53 people across the country have lit themselves on fire to protest the destruction of their homes. That's according to Human Rights and News reports. And while many other countries claim land in the name of development, the extent of the policy in China and the extreme response of some of those losing their homes has been striking. The most recent case of someone setting himself on fire over home demolition occurred in the southern central province of Henan. It began late last month on a sunny Sunday morning when dozens of officials and police arrived with a pair of excavators at the farmhouse of He Mingqing. The local government wants to level He's home to make way for a park, part of a $1.6 billion plan to bring in factories, construct apartment buildings, and develop the economy of Chenzhou, a city about 500,000 people. To find out more on this, we have this special report from Frank Langfitt from National Public Radio.
Late last month, dozens of officials and cops arrived with a pair of excavators at the farmhouse of He Mingqing. They want to level He's village to make way for a park. The park is part of a grand plan to develop the economy of Chenzhou, a city of around 500,000. He's a 42-year-old rice farmer. He'd refused the government's compensation offer of about $33,000. His farmland is his only source of income, and he figured he'd need a lot more money to survive without it. So when the officials came for him, He locked himself inside his house. As family members videoed the scene, the excavators demolished a nearby home, and officials pried open He's door with a crowbar. He then poured gasoline over his head, opened a tank of cooking gas, and lit himself on fire. He's brother, Wai Qing, describes the scene. There were the sounds of explosions, two of them, the brother says. Very thick smoke and fire were coming out of the window. He's family watched as he burned inside his home. A water truck pulled up and fired water through the window. Eventually, workers carried He, his body badly burned, from the building. Wai Qing says he never imagined his brother would try to kill himself, but He's sister-in-law, Li, says he couldn't afford a new house and had run out of options.
He is already in his 40s and has no diploma. His child and the entire family depend on him. He said if he goes out to find work, he would not be able to find any because he has no education and is growing old. He asked, "How can I survive in the future?" The government said, "That's your business." He was helpless and was forced to self-immolate.
I'm in the room where Mr. He lit himself on fire, and you can see that there was a big explosion. The walls and the ceiling are charred black, and on the floor, it's all just soot and ash.
He's brother said he warned officials demolishing the house carried risks.
I told the government official that forced demolition would lead to someone's death. He replied that if someone dies because of this, the government will provide compensation, and it has the money to do so.
The local government blocked official news coverage of the incident. In a statement to NPR, Chenzhou officials said He's house was illegal, that he wanted more than $600,000 in compensation, and that his wife urged him to light himself on fire. He's wife, Huang Xiaoying, denied all of that. Radio Free Asia, which first reported the story, recorded an unnamed official saying the self-immolation was really just a ploy to get more money.
The common people want to get extremely rich through home demolition. They want generations to benefit. That's impossible.
My name is Corinna Barbara Francis, and I'm the China researcher for Amnesty International.
An Amnesty report last year showed that more than 40 people had lit themselves on fire to protest home demolition. Francis says they weren't driven by greed, but desperation.
I think they've come absolutely to the end of their rope. Many of them we know have tried to work through the system. That has failed. They have been neglected. They have been abused.
Yin Sherming felt that way. He used to farm rice and mushrooms in Hunan province. In March 2011, construction workers came to knock down his home to make way for apartment buildings. He doused himself with gas. Yin said he felt angry and helpless. Here's how he put it to China's Southern Metropolis newspaper.
We have filed so many administrative lawsuits, but they make no difference. The courts and the law are of no use to us. We went to Beijing to appeal to higher authorities for help, but we were caught just that afternoon. The police wouldn't protect us. We were taken to a local police station and beaten up by the policemen.
Yan never lit himself on fire. Officials stopped him. But the sort of land seizure that drove him to despair is common.
Nowadays, more than 43% of the villages in China have experienced land takings.
Yu Gao works for Landesa, a rural land rights organization based in Seattle. He says local governments seize farmland to make money, urbanize, and develop their economies. Yu says land sales make up more than 40% of local budgets.
If the government take away that land and convert into highways, apartment buildings, land value will increase a lot.
In the first 9 months of this year, city governments brought in more than $300 billion from land sales. But most farmers never receive anything near the market value of the land they lose. In fact, a 2011 Landesa survey found that more than one in five farmers weren't paid anything at all. One reason, Yu says, is corruption.
Unfortunately, you know, the compensation money out of land takings could easily be intercepted, you know, by local officials. And there is a level of greed, I think. They don't have enough empathy, you know, to the plight of the rural farmers.
Yu consults with officials in Beijing on land seizures.
They are very concerned. And the government now knows if they don't fix, you know, related problems, there will be more social unrest.
China's top leaders are expected to hold a crucial meeting next month to plot the future of the nation's economy. The agenda includes an audacious plan to move 250 million farmers into cities over the next dozen years. If poorly implemented, it could wreak havoc. To avoid that, Yu thinks the government will strengthen compensation and farmers' land rights.
I'm quite optimistic. For instance, you know, farmers in the future, you know, they can get 10 times of the current compensation. It really depends on the political view and determination of the top leadership.
Even if those changes come, it may be too late for He Mengqing. He's still in a coma in the hospital, according to his brother. His family members understand why the local government wants to develop the area and improve the economy. They even support the idea. His brother, Wai Qing, just objects to how it's done.
They're too powerful. We have no way to stop them. If they're really determined to do it, I can only watch them destroy our homes. This type of blind development has no consideration for ordinary people.
Instead of raising farmers' living standards, he says, the government is only driving them down.
And with that report from Frank Langfitt, we've come to the end of this edition of Focus Asia Pacific. If you want to contact us to let us know what you think of the program, our email address is very simple. It's focus@pcjmedia.com. So on behalf of the whole team that helped put the program together, I'm Keith Perron wishing you well. We'll see you again in 7 days' time. Bye, everyone.